welcome to episode number 94 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today's guest is the marvelous, magical Leah Varu. Leah, hi.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I've been wanting to do this for a really long time. For anyone who doesn't know what you do, can you give a quick summary of what you do?
I currently work at W3C as developer relations. Most people, if they've heard my name before, it's because of one of my open source projects like Dablet, which is an online playground for CSS, HTML, and JavaScript, which has some unique features. Prism, which is a very popular syntax highlighter. It's even used in a list apart and many other websites.
It is.
Or Prefix Free, which is a library that lets you write CSS without any prefixes, and many other projects that are on my GitHub page, or I've published many CSS techniques on my blog.
Which is leah.varu.me.
Yeah.
How long, you're relatively young person, young adult, how long have you been coding and designing?
I've been coding for like 15 years. I started at 12.
Okay.
But I only went into web development at 19, which was like 8 years ago. I spent like 7 years coding Visual Basic on my own without anybody using what I was making. And
when self-taught?
Yes. I remember buying a book about C++ at that age, and I couldn't understand it. So I figured that probably C++ is not for me, and I should learn something easier. So I bought a book about Visual Basic, and that was easier to understand. So I started coding with Visual Basic. And I mean, it's kind of embarrassing that my first language was Visual Basic, but I mean, I was only 12. I was very little, so I think that's a good excuse.
Yeah, none of that is embarrassing. That's all pretty amazing. What are there professors in your family, mathematicians in your family? Is there, like in my family, there's a lot of artistic people and a kind of, you know, for me and my brother to be artistic in some capacity. We weren't breaking any new ground. It was sort of what our family, one thing our family kind of does. Do you have family background that explains your...
Well, I don't have any computer science and scientists in the family, but both of my parents were civil engineers. And my mother actually went to MIT for her postgraduate studies on civil engineering. And so they were always very focused on science, and they started teaching me maths before I even went to school. I really owe a lot to them.
Yeah, that's the home stuff is super important. And what kind of stuff did you study, and what kind of things did you make when you were beginning at 12 as a programmer, just doing it for yourself? What kind of things did you make?
I'm a very visual person. I was always interested in generating graphics through programming. So most of the apps I remember building were related to that. They were either some sort of drawing apps that generated graphics through some loop or something, like grids and different kinds of grids and grids that made things look 3D. It's kind of hard to describe. Or I remember making an app that made different kinds of gradients. I remember making a color picker. There were always that sort of visual thing.
So you're still doing the same thing that you were doing when you were 12. You're just doing it in CSS.
I guess that's why I was interested in CSS so much, because it combines the two things I love most, design and coding.
Do you feel that CSS is a well-considered design language?
I think it's very difficult to make a language that's code and designers find it easy to use. Designers prefer to use visual tools like Illustrator. I mean, I love Illustrator. But I think it's much better than other visual languages we have. It's much easier to understand than SVG, for instance. It's much more human readable than SVG or other languages of that sort. So I think given what we have now, it's as good as it gets. Obviously, there could be something better. But
what So did you discover CSS at 17?
I remember first learning PHP. So the way I got into web development was we made a community website with a friend of mine. I was 19 at the time, and we were using some forum software, and eventually we wanted to make changes to it. So I looked into it, and it was all PHP code, and I was like, this is just coding. It's different syntax than what I'm used to, but it's still code. I can learn this. So I started learning PHP.
On your own again.
Yeah, yeah.
By viewing source and by viewing the code and just trying things?
Mostly by reading books and tutorials.
Who did you read? What did you like?
I remember the first book I read about PHP was called something like PHP with Images, but it wasn't really images. It was more like text with screenshots. So I'm not sure why it was called PHP with Images, but apparently it's a whole series. It's like HTML with images, PHP with images.
Yeah. Who publishes that?
I don't remember. It's many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Did you do the same kind of, but PHP isn't really visual. So did you kind of get the whole behavioral separation idea and all that when you were starting, or?
Yeah, eventually I started learning more about HTML and CSS and later JavaScript, and the whole separation just happened naturally. It seemed obvious to create more maintainable code that you need to separate those two. And obviously I read about it in tutorials and books and that sort of thing. So I pretty much started that way. Although I remember when I first started, I was still coding with tables for layout, and I was using CSS for styling. And I was actually one of the, not the last people to switch to CSS for layout, but I was pretty late in that game. I was insisting that tables are good for layout until like 2006.
Sure. 2006?
Yeah, that's pretty embarrassing, I know.
It's not embarrassing. I mean, there were a lot of things that were easy to do in tables, like make one column fixed width and have the other be fluid. Vertical centering, just all kinds of things were easy to do in tables and hard to do in CSS.
Yeah, I cringe when I think of my arguments back then, because I was actually trying to convince people that it's pointless to use CSS for layout because it's much easier to do it with tables. So why should you try and do it with floats and that sort of thing? Yeah.
Are those arguments still online? Did you blog about it, or was this more discussion groups?
I'm pretty sure I posted about it on forums, but it was in Greek. So you would need Google Translate.
So who argued with you?
I don't remember. It was some forum for developers and designers. And we were having these discussions about best practices.
How much of your reading was in English? How much was in Greek?
My very first books about these technologies were in Greek, and eventually I switched to English books because they're more up to date and actually easier to follow. Because when you try to translate technical terms in Greek, it doesn't really work. Nobody can agree on a certain term, so there are multiple different terms for the same thing. There are like four terms for the word browser.
Wow. No standards in the language.
There are standards, but nobody follows them. Some people even just use browser in English, in a Greek text.
The history of English colonization is very sad, very unfortunate, and has repercussions still all through the world. But I'm a benefactor, as someone who grew up speaking. Well, benefactor, and it's easy for me because English is my language, but it's hard for me because I didn't have to embrace another language and learn to think in multiple languages as you and most of my friends from Europe and Asia do. Do you think differently when you're reading in English and reading in Greek?
Yeah, I think at this point I don't think in Greek and translate it in English. I just directly think in English, unless it happens so quickly that I just don't notice. I don't know.
Did you grow up in a multilingual house?
Not really, no.
Was English taught in the school?
Well, I did study. I did take some English classes when I was six, but they were taught by Greeks.
Okay.
So that's not very good. I think my English improved a lot when I started actually going to conferences and talking to people in the industry and making friendships with native speakers of English.
How long have you been? You seem like you, again, you're by my standards, you're very, very young. But you have been a fixture of the conference circuit for, you know, quite a while. When did you start going, and how did you make the transition from attendee to speaker?
I was never an attendee, really. The first conference I attended, I just registered because I didn't want my first conference to be the first conference I speak at. Like, I already had a speaking invitation. And when I got that speaking invitation, at first I thought it was a prank or spam or something like that. And then I saw the list of people they mentioned that are also speaking at that event. It was Front Friends in 2010. And I was like, yeah, that's probably a real invitation. It's not a prank. And I was terrified of speaking in front of like 200 people, which is not even a big audience. But at the time I was so mortified of that thought. And I was like, shut up, Leah, you will do it because it's good for you. So I just said yes. And then I was feeling nervous that would also be my first conference. So I also booked tickets to Frontiers 2010. And it was an amazing experience. I got to meet all these people that I was reading their articles and I was admiring them. And I got to meet them in person and I got a chat with them. It was incredible. I will always remember that conference.
Mm. And you're still friends with a lot of these people.
Yes, yes.
By the time you did that, you'd already created things like Prism, Dablet, correct? By the time you were asked to speak, you'd already made a name for yourself through your work, through your open source projects.
Well, Dablet and Prism came after that. Dablet came in late 2011, I believe, and Prism came in July 2012. But I was already blogging about CSS techniques and that sort of thing.
Okay. And just for yourself, were you writing for magazines?
I don't think I was writing for magazines at the time. I was just blogging on my own website. Okay. And, sorry, it was my second attempt at blogging. I first had started a technical blog in Greek, but nobody was really interested. So I was like, yeah, that's not working. I should try blogging in English. Maybe they'd be interested more. And they were. So that went well.
And you write for .NET Magazine now.
Yeah, I've also written for Smashing Magazine. I've written for A List Apart. Probably other places too.
How did all this happen? It seems like it happened between 2010 and now. That's not a very long time. How do you handle the scheduling of all this stuff?
Yeah, scheduling all this stuff is pretty crazy. I don't think I have a very good solution. I often forget to reply to emails, and sometimes I think I need an assistant, but I can't really afford an assistant, so I have to do it myself, and it's... Yeah, scheduling, that is a question I'm still trying to answer for myself.
Honestly, I would advise you to raise your rates and hire an assistant. I bet there are people listening to the show right now who would love to be your assistant. So, just a thought. But yeah, I have numerous people supporting me. Otherwise, I couldn't function, and I find it overwhelming, very difficult to like get every email, respond to every idea, evaluate every idea. You must get asked to speak and show up all the time. And some people want to pay you thousands of dollars and some people don't want to pay you at all. And some conferences would be a wonderful thing to go to. And I mean, how do you evaluate things like that when you get offers like that?
A great deal of it depends on how much I would like to go to the event as an attendee. Like, especially if I do a talk for free, it needs to be an event that I want to go. even if I hadn't heard of it before, it needs to be something that sounds interesting.
Because of the speakers, because of the location, because of the theme of the conference?
There are many different factors. The speakers, the topics, the location, also the format of the conference, whether it's a one-day conference or a two-day conference, whether it has an after party, whether it's multiple track. I don't like multiple track conferences much. I think they make the whole experience, even though you end up, you might not end up having to attend a talk that you might not like, you can discuss the conference with other attendees afterwards. On a multi-track conference, you're like, I love this talk. And the other person is like, oh, I missed it. I went to that other one.
Thank you. I obviously agree. When Eric and I started our conference, multi-track was the norm. And now there's a whole lot of conferences that are single track, and it's nice to see that. I think it's a better experience too. Everybody having the same experience. Also, a single track conference makes it harder to just isolate with your group. Well, I'm a developer, so I'm going to go to this track. Well, I'm a designer, I'll go to that track. It's really better for people, whatever they think they are, whatever particular discipline they've settled on, to hear about it all and interact with their colleagues, don't you think?
Exactly. It helps you broaden your horizons. You will listen to talks that you otherwise you wouldn't have been exposed to, and learn things that otherwise you wouldn't even have considered learning.
That's my favorite thing, to be at a conference and hear something that I didn't even know I was interested in the topic. Like I remember when I heard about Creative Commons at South by Southwest, it was just being formed, and copyright law was not something I was thinking about at all. And after I heard that, my eyes were opened. It was amazing. Do you like inspiration type conferences more or skills type conferences more? Do you know what I mean?
I like it when there's a balance, but I'm leaning towards code focused talks. I don't like talks that are too fluffy and too inspirational. Maybe one in the whole conference would be okay, but in general, I prefer talks that actually teach me skills. But I don't like talks that discuss a product, like a framework that somebody built or an app that somebody made. I mean, there are good talks like that, but in most cases, it just feels like they're promoting a certain product and they just want to learn more about the technology. I prefer talks that are more about learning the core technologies rather than a framework or a script or an app or whatever.
When you're listening to a colleague give a presentation, are you taking notes by hand or on your computer? Are you tweeting? Are you just listening very attentively and hoping you remember what you learned? What do you do? How do you learn at a conference?
Oh, I never keep notes. I wasn't even keeping notes at university where everybody keeps notes. I'm not a note-taking person. I find taking notes too distracting. I might tweet if it's an amazing talk. Tweeting is distracting, but I feel like I have to do it. If I like a talk, it's me paying tribute to the speaker, because I like it when people do it, when they like my talks. So,
right. It's a social currency, and it's turning on your readers, your followers, letting them know if they get a chance to hear this person, they should.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's a service. You have presentations where you present kind of amazing things that you do in CSS, like things nobody thinks are possible to do in CSS, and you do them live. But I've seen you a few times. You were saying a moment ago that you were very nervous when you were asked to speak, and maybe you still are. It doesn't come across at all. You stand there in total command of that room, and just people's jaws drop because you're just so comfortable writing code live. I've been doing this a long time. I would not be comfortable writing that kind of code live. Not at all. You work 15 hours a day. It's just a language is a part of you now. CSS is just part of you.
Well, keep in mind that I do practice the code samples I write on stage. I don't really practice the talk itself much, but I practice the code examples very thoroughly. So I, I know what I'm going to write, even if it seems that it's spontaneous. I know what I'm going to write. I've practiced it before. Sometimes I might do something that I just thought of, but in most cases I've practiced those examples. And also, they're very short examples, not just to eliminate the chance of me making mistakes, but also because I don't think audiences can easily follow long pieces of code. So I try to keep them at the bare minimum needed to demonstrate what I'm doing.
Right. It doesn't sound like you're practicing remembering the code you need to write. It seems like you're practicing, how can I structure the presentation of this so it's as few lines of code as possible? Every line of code teaches something. It's easy to understand what that line of code teaches. And the person can walk away going, oh, I can do that. Even if they didn't memorize, they understand what they can do.
Yeah, I try to explain the thought process behind it. Like, how did I come up with that line of code? Because if I just type it as if you're watching a video, that doesn't really help, right? The whole point is to show how I came up with that code and to show the intermediate results as you write the solution, how every line of code affects what you see, not just the end state, which would happen if I was using static slides like Keynote.
You're right. Do people ever complain that they tried to download your slides and where's the code? Because it's all live. Do people complain or do you provide the code in some fashion?
Yeah, some people have asked for the code. What I do sometimes, although I haven't done it for a while, I run the presentation myself afterwards and I take screenshots of every stage and then I put them in a PDF. And that allows me to share the slides on websites like Slide Deck or SlideShare, that sort of thing.
Okay, I was wondering about that. Okay, well, that's a simple process. You're writing a book, too. Is that correct? Or you've written a book?
I'm writing a book with
CSS
O'Reilly.
CSS Secrets?
That's right.
O'Reilly is a very nice publisher. Very good publisher. Very good code publisher.
And they're very open-minded as well. Like, the book itself will be styled with CSS because they have a system where you write ASCII doc for the text and you style the book with CSS. And I mean,
get out of town. Really?
Yes. How awesomely meta is that? A book about CSS, which is styled with CSS. That's the reason I chose them over other publishers. Well, one of the reasons.
What's the language again? What's the process? You write in ASCII text?
ASCII doc. It's a plain text markup language similar to Markdown, but a bit more complicated.
Holy cow. Okay, well, I have to find out about that. This is the first time I've ever heard of that, which is maybe shocking, but I had not heard of that.
And you have a Git repository with your book, and you can clone it locally and write your ASCII doc files and then push it, and you have version control as well. It's so cool. And other publishers still use Word templates.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
So old-fashioned.
Change is hard. O'Reilly, well, I think it comes from the top. Tim O'Reilly is a brilliant technical person. So, and they, you know, he's on the forefront of this stuff. So it would be awkward and strange if the company used Word and, you know, stuff like that to as part of their process. So the editor then comes in on your GitHub repository and proofreaders, and they just edit and save a version in Git? How does that work?
See, they have built an entire system around this. So the tech editor can just go in the system and add comments where they think there's an issue. And there's a GUI for that. It's really easy to use. Unfortunately, for some reason, the proofreader will proofread the PDF, the generated PDF. I have no idea why.
That actually makes sense. They're looking at a proof. A PDF is like a proof, a digital proof of what the readers will see. And it may be easier to catch mistakes that way, like writing the twice or something like that. The things that we all do without thinking about it.
You know, right. Yeah, that makes sense.
When is this book coming out?
Spring 2014, although I will try to finish it earlier, but my deadline is around spring 2014.
That's the deadline for it being published, not the deadline for you turning in the final manuscript. And the name is CSS Secrets?
Yes.
And if we've seen the presentations you're making this year and last year, will we have some clue what it's about? Is it going to be along those same lines?
It's going to be along the same lines, but obviously with a lot more secrets. I've done two CSS Secrets presentations at multiple conferences. Each of them had 10 CSS secrets, and the book will have more like 50, 60. I haven't quite counted them, but they're way more.
Today's Big Web Show episode is sponsored by lynda.com. You can learn it at lynda.com, an online learning company with more than 98,000 video tutorials that teach software, creative, and business skills. Membership starts at $25 per month and provides unlimited 24/7 access to top-quality video courses taught by expert instructors with real-world experience. Learn anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace. From bite-sized tutorials to comprehensive courses in web design, development, business, photography, audio and video, 3D and animation. Sharpen your skills in Bootstrap, jQuery, CSS, JavaScript, HTML, user experience, content strategy, and more. Stay current with modern best practices. With new courses added every week, the lynda.com library helps you keep pace with the fast-changing technical and software skills required by today's working professionals. Learn on the go with optimized mobile site or the free lynda.com iPhone and iPad app for members. Try lynda.com free for 7 days by visiting lynda.com/bigwebshow. That's free for 7 days by visiting lynda.com/bigwebshow. Talk us through the creative process that you come, I mean, what makes you say, I'm going to write some CSS that changes border shape in a way I've never seen before? How do you, are you looking at someone's business card? Are you looking at a plaque on a doorbell and go, I wonder if I could do that in CSS? How do you come up with your ideas? Because that's pretty fascinating. Not just that you can do it, but that you think to do it.
Well, sometimes it's actually like that. Can I do this with CSS? Not just for things I see around me, also things I see on websites. Like today, I saw the progress indicator that Chrome puts on tabs, and I was wondering if I can do that with SVG and dash array and CSS animations. I haven't quite managed yet, but I did discover a Chrome bug, which I'm going to report. Sometimes I just wonder if something could be done in CSS, and I try. It's basically problem solving. I try to solve this problem, and it's not like I come up with solutions instantly. Sometimes I might have problems in my head for like as a background process for even months. Like about 1 or 2 years ago, Chris Coyer came to me and he was like, "Can we do an animation of an element going in a circle?" I'm sure you've seen this in my talk, and. At first, I thought we both concluded that we can't. We need to make multiple keyframes to approximate a circle. And I thought of a solution like 2 months later, 3 months later. It's just at some point I realized that you can cancel transforms with inner transforms of the opposite direction, like having a rotate 45 degrees on an outer element and a rotate minus 45 degrees on the inner element that cancels it. And at some point, I thought, hey, I can solve this circle problem with this technique if I just use it in animations, if every keyframe is canceling the rotate transforms so that the element just moves in the circle.
You remind me of other really brilliant CSS people I know who think in terms of math and love math. Again, your folks were civil engineers, so that makes sense. What about a designer who just hates math or can't grasp math? How can they be a digital designer? What would you advise them to do?
That's a good question, really. I haven't quite thought about it. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine a completely different thought process. I love math. I was second in Greece in math when I was at school.
Say that again. Second in math in Greece when you were in school. in the whole country.
Yeah, I got a second prize in mathematics, although I used to be obsessed with mathematics when I was like 16, 17, but I've pretty much forgotten most of them by now. The thinking remains, though. So it's very difficult to imagine a different thought process and advice somebody for it. I guess having better visual tools would help people that don't like maths. But still.
I don't think there's ever going to be a visual tool that will make something move in a circle in CSS or really just design a fluid layout that it works. And there are, Adobe has a tool that's pretty awesome. There are people trying really hard to solve this problem, but do you believe that 5-10 years from now we'll have visual tools that write semantic markup and smart CSS?
I think there's certainly room for better visual tools, and I'm surprised nobody has managed to build better visual tools. But the thing is, the kind of maths you need in CSS, in most cases, they're not really advanced maths. You don't need to calculate integrals in CSS or even in JavaScript. I've never really needed anything advanced. So it's not something that designers, even the most visual of designers, cannot learn.
Tell me about your journey into JavaScript. How did that happen, and how comfortable are you?
Oh, I love JavaScript. It's funny because most people think that I'm a CSS person, and they think I don't really know JavaScript. And I'm like, how do you think I made all these tools with just CSS alone? You can't really do that. Or maybe you can, but it would be so inefficient with like thousands of lines of code of CSS. You can do anything with CSS. But the question is if it's a good idea to do it with CSS.
Right.
Anyway, so like I mentioned, at first I started with PHP, and then I learned HTML and CSS. So I was building when I first started, I was building extensions to the forum software vBulletin. I was releasing them as open source in the forum that forum software had for extensions. And at some point I noticed that other people were building extensions that were more interactive, that you didn't have to wait for a page reload for something to happen. So I realized I want to make this sort of thing myself. I want my extensions to be more dynamic. And I think the first thing I ever coded in JavaScript was a smiley generator. It was this app which allowed you to pick like different eyes and different mouths and different faces, and you could make a smiley to use in a forum. It probably still exists somewhere on the web. And the image was replaced with JavaScript, although it didn't use Canvas to build the smiley. It just changed the URL of the image to fetch a different smiley dynamically generated with PHP. But it was my first attempt to make something more interactive that didn't need page reloads for interaction.
Are those things still on the web?
That one is, I'm pretty sure, on the official website for vBulletin extensions.
Is what happens to your early work? Did you host it all yourself? Is a lot of it, you know, somewhere on your server, or?
The apps I made as a teenager are not anywhere. They were in my old computer. And from what I heard, that computer is kind of dead now because of a flood or something many years ago. But my first adventures into web development are in that website, vBulletin.org.
Spell it.
vBulletin.
vBulletin.org, that's right. Is that still up?
Yes. The software is used by multiple people, the vBulletin software. Although my extensions are from a very old version of vBulletin.
Right.
So, but they're still used by many forums that are stuck on old versions.
Is there a lot of flexibility in vBulletin, like visual flexibility to change the look and feel?
There is, but in this day and age, I wouldn't advise people. There are better software. There are better scripts for forums these days.
What do you like?
I'm not really into forums anymore, so I don't really remember the names, but I've seen some much more modern ones. Vblink has amazing software architecture, but it's built by mostly back-end developers. Their front-end developers is not as good.
Do you make a living creating open-source projects, or do you do client work, consulting? How does that all work?
Well, until today, until the end of July, I'm working for W3C full-time, so I don't really have to think about that for the past year. Before that, I was doing lots of different things, really. Workshops, client work, many different things.
You wrote a post on your blog today that says that you're leaving W3C at the end of July 31st, as you just mentioned. But it's a very amicable separation. It's just you want to do new stuff, right?
Yeah. I mean, W3C has been my dream ever since I heard what a web standard is. And there are so many brilliant people at W3C, and it's been a pleasure to work with them. But at some point, I realized that I wasn't happy. I wasn't feeling creative enough. I wanted to have more time to work on my open source projects. I want to have more time to devote to the CSS working group. I wanted to have more time to do my own thing, really. And I remember I had much more free time when I was self-employed. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not that W3C overworked me or anything. It was my fault that I was working pretty much all the time.
Yeah. So, and you have an awesome boss too. Will have had an awesome boss, Doug Shappers. Are they going to hire someone in your place?
Yeah. Although the job description is quite different from the job description I had last year. That's also one of the reasons I left.
Sure.
Because there was in the new job, there was a stronger focus on doing front-end development and front-end design and documentation on webplatform.org, which is a very interesting job, but it's not what I personally wanted to do.
You'll still be involved with W3C on the CSS working group.
I think it's pretty likely that I remain as an invited expert. There were many people that wanted to invite me as an invited expert before I would join W3C, and they didn't because I was going to join W3C. So I don't see why I wouldn't stay in the CSS working group.
What are you going to be doing next?
Pretty much what I was doing before W3C.
So writing, lecturing, making open source projects, traveling.
Writing my book.
Writing your book.
Also, I think I'll devote like 2 or 3 months full time on that, starting in August. Because I'm going to design it as well. So that's quite a lot of work. It's not going to be an animal book. It's going to have a completely different design than other O'Reilly books.
Do you want to talk about that?
Sure, if you have any questions about it.
Do you have a concept already?
I've designed some spreads. I've designed a spread on Illustrator, and I've been discussing it with my editor. She really likes it, and she showed it to other people, and they really liked it as well. So I just have to port it in CSS now.
You have to design the cover in CSS?
No, the inside of the book.
The inside.
So I have to port it to CSS and...
Have you studied print design, and are you comfortable with making a nice readable, you know, something that will be readable in print? Because it's a very different medium and all that. Yeah, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I haven't gone to school for graphic design, but I'm really passionate about it. I've read many, many books on it. And when I first started freelancing, I mean, I was pretty young at the time. I was like 19. And I was doing some print design as well. And eventually I just concentrated on web. But I'm pretty self-taught when it comes to design. I mean, for development, I went to computer science university. But for design, it's just me and my books and whatever practice I have. But it's something I really love. I love code and design equally. And yeah. I really want to do more design.
The web is great for that, for people who love design and code equally. I don't even know how you pick one. Unless you just, you know, I suppose some people are just so amazingly gifted at design that they don't even want to deal with code. But, or some people are just so gifted at code that they don't want to. But to me, the beauty of it is that it appeals to these two different sides of the brain and that both things are creative. You know, to say, well, this is the creative person and this is the coder is very silly and would miss the point completely. This code is very creative and very difficult to do well.
Yeah, I think code is art, really.
I think so, too. I have a friend who wants to improve her skills and be more employable and so on. What would you say to someone like that? This person knows HTML and CSS. What should they study next?
I think it's more important to have deep knowledge in something rather than shallow knowledge in lots of things. So I generally advise people to concentrate more on something they like and go really deep on it and become an expert on it, because there aren't many experts. There are many generalists, but there aren't many experts on certain technologies. So I think somebody who's an expert on like CSS or JavaScript or HTML or whatever is much can find a much better job than somebody who's kind of okay at all of them.
How do you become an expert on that one thing? Who do you read or what do you do? What's the process to become someone like you?
Are you calling me an expert?
Oh, of course you are. Yeah, of course you are.
Thank you. Read blogs on the subject, read the specs themselves. I mean, there are lots of documentation. There's lots of documentation, but all documentation is taken from the specs. It's always secondhand.
Specs can be very vague, though, or confusing.
Some specs are easier to read than others. CSS specs are some of the easiest specs I've seen to read. So I think it's always a good idea to read the spec first. And if you can't understand it, look at documentation.
I just remember reading CSS 1 and reading that a pixel was defined as a something part of the what your retina does when the screen is at an average male adult arm's length from your eye or so. And I just went like, because I thought it was just a dot on the screen. I remember just being like turned off by that.
Yeah.
CSS 3 seems more practical in the way the little modules are written up. It seems clearer in the way the modules are written up.
Well, CSS 2.1 was also equally clear, I think.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it was easier to follow because it was just one small spec, and now it's like 60 specs.
What's your feeling about the WebKit forking that's going on with Chrome and now with Google Glass? Good thing, bad thing, neutral thing?
I think it's great to have diversity, and it kind of fills a gap that Opera left when Opera decided to switch to Chromium. So at least now we have the same number of different rendering engines as before. And I mean, yes, Blink is pretty much the same as WebKit right now, but eventually they will diverge. So we'll have multiple separate rendering engines, which is great for standards as well.
Because?
For a specification to advance from candidate recommendation status to proposed recommendation and then recommendation.
Because more than two browsers can support it.
It needs two interoperable implementations, at least two. So fewer engines means less chance for specifications to advance.
Does forking also mean that there's more of a playground for, say, one browser maker to take the lead on a particular specification and let people play with it? But because of progressive enhancement, if someone else's browser doesn't support it, it's not a problem, right?
if you use progressive enhancement, sure. Unfortunately, sometimes developers get carried away and we forget to use progressive enhancement. There was a recent article by Jake Archibald about this very thing. And it's very interesting. I suggest people look it up. It was a great read.
Yeah. And he alluded to an earlier article in that article. Let me find it again. Okay. Progressive enhancement is still important. And which is at jakearchibald.com. If you go to jakearchibald.com, you'll find it immediately. I linked to both articles because I like them both very much. It's probably at the bottom. Emil Bjorklund, who wrote Progressive Enhancement, Still Not Dead, on 2nd of July. And he's at thatemil.com. If you go to thatemil.com, I think both articles are nice. And they're a nice 1-2 punch. It's crazy to me that with all the struggle we've all done to get to this place in web standards and accessibility, interoperability, that there are still people who think it's a really good idea to say, well, you know, this will only work for this group of people, and that's fine. I'm fine with that. I don't understand that. I never understood that thinking, but I had thought we were past that now.
People forget very, very easily. For instance, we went through the monoculture thing with IE6. And we all know what happened and what pains it caused us, and still people are very willing to code just for a certain rendering engine, just for WebKit, for instance, especially on mobile. Most people don't care about other rendering engines, and
right.
It's basically a WebKit monoculture on mobile.
Well, that's why Opera's changed.
Exactly, yeah. Like, they even had to implement WebKit's prefix, which is crazy if you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that was... Can you explain for anyone who's not familiar with that little story real quickly what you
So, Opera realized that many people were using CSS properties that were prefixed with hyphen WebKit hyphen for WebKit-based browsers, and they didn't care about progressive enhancement when these properties were not available. And they weren't just properties that were just making the styling a bit better, but they were actually making websites inaccessible to people with browsers that didn't support these properties, especially properties like WebKit text size adjust. So the solution they eventually came up with was to implement WebKit prefix properties. And even Firefox said they were thinking of doing the same thing.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. So... I want to thank you for coming on the show today. I want to thank you for the projects that you've made, including ones we use at A List Apart. And I want to wish you a lot of luck with the book. Thank you for your service at W3C, and wish you a lot of luck with the everything that comes after. And if people are interested in you and what you do, where should they look for you online?
Either my Twitter account, Leah Veru, or my website, leah.veru.me. I just wanted to say my website also links to my Twitter account, so I guess I should have just given my website.
No, you did great. Thank you very much for today, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeffrey.
Pleasure.